listener production.
A warning. This episode contains references to violent crime. Welcome to Crime Insiders Forensics. For those joining us for the first time, my name's Catherine Fox. I'm a former GP, crime author, and screenwriter. I'm enthralled by forensics and have spent thousands of hours researching for books and screenplays. So I thought, why not turn my research into a podcast? Every week, you'll be joining me in discovering how forensic science is helping solve high-profile crimes in Australia and around the world. This week, how the forensic analysis of soil is helping solve high-profile Australian crimes and providing hope in all but forgotten cold cases.
We analysed mud particles in a pyjama top from a young girl that had been snatched from her bedroom and never found.
Professor Robert Fitzpatrick is a forensic soil scientist with decades of experience in criminal and environmental forensic cases. We'll gain an understanding of how soil analysis uses diverse techniques which have dozens of practical applications, including how it helped locate the bodies of the victims in one of South Australia's most high-profile double homicides. But first, an introduction into the science of forensic soil analysis.
So the word pedology means everything under the foot. So pedo is foot and ology is soil, which is the very surface of the soil. So as a pedologist, which is a subdiscipline of soil science, what we do is we endeavour to understand how soils form, why they are there, in other words, the mapping, and more importantly, their origin, how the soils have actually got there. So in terms of forensics, what we're doing in forensic soil science is we actually try to understand how that soil got there over months, years, or decades.
There's a case that you actually showed this in. Can you tell us about that very first case?
So the very first case we did in year 2000 was now a pretty famous case called the Matthew Holding case, where Matthew Holding had disappeared. His father had found the car, family car, missing. Both his mother and his grandmother were missing as well. And unfortunately, he found lots of glass and blood and everything in the kitchen and around the house. So he notified the police about what he'd found, and he'd found this in what is called the Adelaide Hills. So that's a very high elevated area in South Australia. And just many hours later, they found the missing vehicle on York Peninsula of South Australia, which is about 150 kilometres away from where they lived, towards the coast, and the car had broken down. In the boot of the car, they'd found a shovel, bracelets, some glass, and Matthew Holding, who was driving the vehicle, was trying to find someone to help fix the vehicle. Anyway, they connected the dots and they arrested him. And the thought was, well, we've got all the evidence of that something had happened or foul play. And they asked him, well, where's your mother and your grandmother? And he said, well, you'll never find them. So the police assumed that the missing bodies or the missing persons were on York Peninsula, 150 kilometres away. So they spent several days searching the York Peninsula coastline and so on, and eventually gave up because they couldn't compare the soil that was on the shovel with the soil that was there. So in a sort of an emergency, they called me in. They asked me to look at the shovel, and very quickly I could see that, in fact, the soil, just based on looking and very simple testing, certainly did not come from the York Peninsula, which is a very arid zone part of South Australia. It appeared to us that this soil, and by knowing the different shapes of the particles, the colour of the soil, that it definitely came from a very high rainfall area and was very likely to have come from a quarry or even a mine. So that immediately then they engaged me to assist them to try and find out where we could possibly find the missing persons. So I assisted the police in using soil maps that we had of the high rainfall areas of South Australia. We looked at the geology, we looked at where all the quarries were, the mines were, and I went on searches with the detectives. And at some stage, we had close to 30 detectives working on this job. I can recall sitting in a big conference with these detectives, and I said to them, look, I'm certain it would come from a quarry, and it would be a wet area in a quarry, because looking at the shovel, it had been compacted and the shovel had already started rusting around the edges. And it was obviously wet when the person had banged the soil down on certainly the back of the shovel. And I then said to them, well, look, we've got to do more searching of the quarries. And we had already done that and identified a few quarries. And I can recall them saying to the one particular, the lead detective, that, look, it's not going to happen. And we then went to these very wet quarries. We visited most of them, and we visited this one wet quarry. And I sampled the soils in the surrounding areas of the quarry, took the soils back to the laboratory, and I compared them visually with the soil from the quarry and the soil from on the shovel. We then X-rayed the soil on the shovel, and we X-rayed the soil from the quarry. And the comparison was incredible. It was like, there's never a perfect match, but this was very close to that. So I phoned the lead detective and I said, look, I am 99% certain that the soil on the shovel comes from a particular quarry. Now, it had started raining. They had searchers walking through there on horseback, which had almost like polluted the soil because the dogs then couldn't search. And we then had another meeting with the detectives, and this lead detective said, look, I come from a farming background, and I believe that if I came out every morning in this particular quarry that Rob believes that there's a comparison, I believe that the foxes will be in there. And there was just laughter from a lot of his colleague detectives. Anyway, he visited that quarry every morning, and on the second morning, the first body was dug up by the foxes, and I got this big invitation to please come out and see everything happen. I said, no, I don't think I can stomach that. So the next day, the foxes then uncovered the next body. Now, if you think about it, where he had buried the two bodies, it was almost the perfect place, because when you really think about where to bury someone, it would be in a quarry that soil's all disturbed anyway, and in a wet place where it's difficult to get into. So we made that comparison. They found the bodies, and of course that made the trial very much easier, because basically they'd found the two bodies and they could then use the DNA that they had and all that sort of thing to make the comparisons.
Going back a step, when you were given the shovel, you mentioned identifying by looking. What is the actual procedure you do when you get a sample that you need to examine?
Almost the very first technique we use is to measure the colour. And colour tells about the wetness of the soil, the types of iron minerals that are in the soil. It gives a lot of information. But of course, then there are standard methods that we use as well to determine the texture of the soil, how much clay, how much sand, how much silt is in the soil. So all these tests we do are what are called soil morphology analyses. So we're using visual techniques to describe the soil. We then move to doing analyses like pH of the soil, the electrical conductivity of the soil, which tells you how much salt is in the soil, And then as the sort of final stage, we would go to fancy gadgets. And the most powerful tool is X-ray diffraction, which tells you the type of mineral particles that are in the soil. The other methods as well is infrared spectroscopy that can tell you about the organic matter composition and so on.
You worked out logically that it was a quarry. Isn't it more sensible that someone would dig a wet soil rather than a sandstone or solid, which would be far more difficult? And similarly, as you mentioned, burying bodies in a wet part of a quarry is difficult to get to, but presumably it's also difficult to get to for the person doing it.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the very, very wet part of the quarry. So it was sort of the edge of the very wet area that the person dug. We could see from the shape of the particles on the quarry and from the soil on the shovel that it wasn't from a normal soil. A normal soil, the particles would be much more rounded. There'd be more organic matter in it because that would be near the surface where things are growing. Where there was no organic matter in the shovel at all. There was also lots of tiny particles of what is called talc. It's a mineral that's very rarely found in the topsoils. It would be more found in the sort of in-depth quarries and that sort, particularly where we were looking. So there were sort of indicator minerals that really pointed to it had to be this quarry. And talc, for example, which is a very rare mineral in soils, when we found that comparison on the shovel and in the quarry, I was almost 99.99% certain that there was a comparison.
And you had no idea whether or not Matthew Holding, the accused, had any experience in quarries or was familiar with that area?
No, I didn't at all. But he didn't live, from what I understood, I think he'd driven his motorbikes or vehicles and stuff in and around these quarries, which was nearby his home in the Adelaide Hills. So he was quite familiar with the sort of geography of quarries.
Did you also look at the car tyres, for example, for dirt or soil within the tread?
Yes, we did. But of course, he'd driven 150 kilometres from there. So, and they hadn't actually, for that particular case, put the car, taken it back carefully to an archival police depot, which is quite often what we do now. We go to the depot, they put the car up on a ramp and we go and we sample underneath. So if they arrest someone, the protocol now is that they would immediately take the vehicle. We would go and then sample underneath the vehicle, particularly inside the inner rims. We've done many cases where we've sampled such soils and then made that comparison to the dirt roads where they may have been on.
How did you feel when you heard that the bodies of Matthew's mother and grandmother were found?
It was incredible when I think about it. But at the time, it was pretty exciting. And what was quite bizarre, in a sense, was that CSIRO at the time could not understand how good this was. They said, was it really that important? I mean, it's what you do every day. You compare soils. And I then relayed that information back to the detectives and the commissioner, actually, of South Australia. They immediately contacted CSIRO and they said, do you realise that the work that we had done had saved millions of dollars in terms of a court case? In other words, they didn't have to hold a court case, which would have gone on for months. That alone changed the thinking of CSIRO and all my managers around me, because from that, we then decided that we should set up a centre within CSIRO, and to the credit of CSIRO, they then supported it tremendously, not just because of the money, but they could see the significance of the work that we do and did to the community. And of course, the rest is history, because we've done well over 200 cases subsequently. So it started off as a frustrating story, but we've ended up, it's wonderful what we've done. And I can only give great credit to CSIRO for that happening.
In terms of size of specimen or evidence, how much do you need? You require a certain amount of DNA and they're able to get smaller and smaller, but again, it degrades and over periods of time and weather and circumstances. Is that the same with soil? Are you getting more and more sensitive to getting smaller specimens, or do you need a decent sized specimen to be able to analyse it?
So when we first started doing the soil forensics work, you usually would ask for as much soil as we can get. Well, we still do that. But in many of the cold cases that we've had to deal with recently, or over the last 10, 20 years, the clothing that we've been given would have just trace amounts of soil particles. In fact, so buried into the fabric of the material that you can't see it with the naked eye. But under a microscope, we can see it. So what we've actually developed in our X-ray diffraction laboratory, and I'm extremely privileged to work with outstanding mineralogists, X-ray specialists, and without them, I could not do the work. So we've done two cases where we've actually could see under a microscope these particles. We've then suggested to the detectives and the courts that we could actually take these samples to what is called the Australian synchrotron, which, by the way, costs in the region of about $10,000 a day to analyze the soils using the Australian synchrotron X-ray diffraction beam line. And what that enables you to do is to X-ray tiny little particles very quickly and very accurately. It almost magnifies the diffraction pattern so we can determine what minerals are in there more accurately. So really the breakthrough for us has been the analysis of very tiny particles. And we have two case studies where we've had a breakthrough, the one being tiny brick particles that were in a person's bra strap that had been found in a grave in Western Australia. They found the body, and allegedly she had been murdered in her front yard. So we were given the task of analysing the particles in her bra strap. Well, first of all, we had to discover the particles in her bra strap, which is what we did. I flew from Adelaide to Perth and collected her bra, brought it back to Adelaide, and then we did these analysis. It took us 3 months. We then extracted the different brick particles from her bra strap, and we then compared these particles with every brick that was sampled in the front yard. So the detectives and the police had then chipped brick fragments from every brick in the front yard. We were given those brick fragments. We pulverized them and compared them with the brick fragments that were in her bra strap. So our forensic report was close to nearly 700 pages long because of all the analysis we did at the Australian Synchrotron. And we could compare these particles of bricks from her bra strap with those in the front yard. Now, two or three of the bricks were quite unique because these bricks are brought in, they're old bricks. So it's almost a unique patch of bricks that are in her front yard. It would be almost impossible to duplicate that brick pattern in any other backyard or front yard anywhere in the world. So we could make that comparison, and that was a judge-only case that was presented in the courts in Western Australia, and the judge had agreed with our analyses that the particles that were found on a bra strap did come from that front yard. So the connection of being able to say that she'd been dragged, I could not give that evidence in court because I'd never done dragging experiments. And they could not prove without doubt that, in fact, the person had committed the murder. So the person actually was not ever committed, but the judge did make the decision or assessment that she was murdered in the front yard. By who? We don't know. there's an interesting additional story to this because at that particular time, a PhD student was starting her PhD and she was fascinated by this case. So she decided with our co-supervisors that her PhD project would be to study brick particles and soil particles on bras and bra straps. So she wrote 5 papers on bras and she did these dragging experiments, which meant we published work, which meant that a case 3, 4, 5 years later in which I had to give evidence on transference of particles into a pajama top that was part of a cold case permitted me to give that evidence in court and write it in my report. So I actually conducted transference experiments on a pajama top from mud and based on her PhD thesis to analyze very tiny particles. Again, we did that in the synchrotron. We analyzed mud particles that were entrapped in a pajama top from a young girl that had been snatched from her bedroom in Adelaide and never found. But DNA, 35 years later, did identify the person and a court case was then established based on the DNA and circumstantial evidence that the person was likely to have buried her in a particular estuary in South Australia, which we had samples for. So I could compare those samples with the samples on her pajama top that was found. So I was able to give evidence in court for that cold murder case. First of all, comparing the particles from that particular estuary with the particles in her pajama top. But in addition to that, we could then give evidence that the particles were forced within the fabric, which meant the pajama top had been forced into mud. And I could not have done that if I hadn't have actually worked with a PhD student in doing transference experiments.
To clarify, was the body found or was the pajama top found?
The pajama top was found, but the body was never, ever found. And that's what made this case particularly fascinating or difficult to do. So it was all based on circumstantial evidence.
So the actual victim's DNA was on the pajama top?
Correct.
So you were trying to identify where the victim had been buried?
Yeah, so basically the perpetrator's DNA was found on the pajama top 30-something years later, and that person was a teacher, and that person was eventually prosecuted. He actually was in jail at the time, and they managed to use special DNA evidence to be able to make that comparison. And then they needed additional circumstantial evidence to prove that this could have happened. And so our soil evidence was, if you like, the additional evidence that was used by the prosecutors in terms of a circumstantial scenario of what had happened. And the person was eventually prosecuted for life.
In terms of types of crime, you mentioned 200 crimes that you've been involved with. What sorts of crimes otherwise are we looking at apart from murder, for example?
So I've been involved with archaeologists in looking at massacres, the Australian massacre sites, Aboriginal massacres in the Northern Territory, Western Australia. They've been fascinating. Again, we had enough soil particles to, in fact, verify what had happened. We've also done work on dinosaur bones and dinosaur nests that had been imported illegally to Australia. And they discovered these dinosaur nests. And, of course, the people who purchased them said, well, they don't come from China, which is where they were likely from. And it's illegal to purchase any dinosaur bones or nests from China.
Does the nest involve the eggs?
The eggs as well, yes. Dinosaur eggs, dinosaur nests. So what we did was through our colleagues, mineralogist colleagues at the South Australian Museum, the Victorian Museum, we could get examples of dinosaur eggs and nests from China. The particular people that had purchased them said, oh, no, they come from the USA, where you're allowed to purchase dinosaur nests and eggs. So we got from the museum, we could actually get samples from the USA, and we would then make the comparison, we'd x-ray them, and we could prove definitively that, in fact, they would have come from Henan Province, China, because the mineralogy of that particular province is pretty unique. And when you compare it to what's in the USA, they're completely different. So we could, again, assist. In this case, it happened to be the Australian Federal Police who is doing the work to verify that, yes, they were dinosaur eggs from Henan Province, China.
Rob, I was astonished to discover that you had a top secret security clearance for your jobs involving counterterrorism. How on earth do they work?
So I have top secret security clearance mainly to work with the Australian Federal Police that are primarily involved in counterterrorism cases across the nation. And essentially what that means is that when I'm involved in a counterterrorism case, I'm notified of that. And then if I'm presented with some evidence that they want me to give judgment on, I'm not held to account in a court of law if, in fact, I'm proven wrong. So, for example, they give me a garment to look at. It's mostly a shovel or an implement where digging has occurred, and they'd say to me, where do I think anywhere in Australia would the soil might have come from? So I would look at it and I'd say, well, it could come from the arid zone. It could come from nature reserve in Sydney, for example. It could come from a farming area in South Australia, for example. I could give that type of judgment, and that would then assist the police in their search. Very rarely I'd be called out to assist them with the search. I have done that. I've had flown to various places and I'd assist them with the search. So that is very different to if I'm approached by detectives or the DPP to give evidence about a comparison of a soil or on a particular case or an accused, then I would have to collect those samples, put them in a proper archive, document everything in a logbook, because then the defence lawyers can ask for that information, which they do, rightfully so, whereas in the counterterrorism cases, I'm excluded from that. But of course, if in a counterterrorism case goes to court and I then have to accumulate evidence, and I've done that, that then turns into a proper court case and I do then have to keep notes and that sort of thing and be very accurate. So there is a slight difference in my initial call to give them some advice on a counterterrorism case that it would involve soil evidence.
How do you feel when some of your work is actually instrumental in gaining conviction or stopping a criminal activity continuing?
There are two parts to that. After I've given evidence, there is an element of, you know, you've got to be absolutely 100% certain that what you're doing or giving evidence of is correct. But, you know, there's always the chance that you could be wrong. And my colleagues who work with me would say to me, you know, we just may be wrong in terms of what we've done. Well, we've given the evidence that we've done, and of course it's up to the courts to make the final judgment. And it's the job of the courts, particularly the defence barristers, to cross-examine one. And in many cases, I'd be cross-examined for days, a whole day at a time, 2 days at a time. And that is horrendously stressful. And of course, the media are there. I always recall giving evidence in Western Australia, a very prominent defence lawyer at one stage said to me, well, you know, this new stuff you've done at the Australian Synchrotron is junk science. That was the headline news, CSIRO junk science. You know, that sort of thing makes it stressful, makes it difficult. But at the end of the day, when justice is done, the juries have made decisions, yes, most definitely it's satisfying. And the only way we can explain this to our colleagues around the world is to publish these examples of how we've used soils and demonstrated the power that soil has that can assist forensic scientists and, of course, the justice system to get people to be convicted if they've in fact done something wrong.
That also helps debunk the junk science concept.
Absolutely. And that drove my X-ray colleagues and myself to be determined to publish the evidence we had in a journal, because and so in many ways the justice system helps. I mean, another example of how they've helped us in the production of our forensic guidance manual, understand the defense lawyers read these things forensically and they find errors. So I'm at version 10 at the moment. I'm actually revising it to version 12. Now, I couldn't have done that without their input in terms of being cross-examined and making it much more accurate, you know, about what we've said in there, how we've expressed what we got. So in some ways, our legal system is good in that it does refine the sort of things that we do in forensic soil science, in particular, the chain of custody of samples. So you can do all this amazing work, but if you don't conduct the chain of custody properly and store the samples properly, it's just chucked out of court by the defence lawyers, and rightfully so.
Well, I think forensic soil science is very exciting, and I'm very grateful that you are doing the work you're doing, and I think there's so much hope for cold cases potentially in your work, as well as current criminal cases. So, Rob, thank you so much for joining us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Crime Insiders Forensics is a listener original production. It's hosted by me, Catherine Fox, and is produced by Ed Gooden. Sound design and imaging is by Link Kelly.